Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. Just wrapped up a great conversation with Alex Leishman, CEO of River Financial. River is doing some amazing things in the Bitcoin space, and Alex is an awesome guy to talk to. He's technical. He understands the philosophical implications of Bitcoin. We covered a lot about River, what they do, how they've architected the business differently than many other Bitcoin companies. We talked about their involvement in the Lightning Network, its advantages, some of its challenges for scaling long term, and what Alex sees coming down the pipeline in Bitcoin for the rest of the year. It was a great conversation. I really hope you enjoy it. All righty, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Alex here with me. Alex, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Well, hey, I want to be, a lot of topics I want to cover with you. Really want to start here with your work at River and what you all do, the mission that you're on. And I think that'll transition nicely into a lot of the other things we could cover.
Yeah. So you know, at River, we believe that Bitcoin is going to help make our financial system more robust and honest. Our mission at River is to accelerate the adoption of Bitcoin to further this goal. More tangibly, what we're building at River is the Bitcoin bank of the world. So I'll use the term bank in quotes. We're not sort of a federally chartered bank. We are what we think a bank should look like on a Bitcoin standard, 100% reserve, encouraging people to self-custody. We make it very easy for people to buy Bitcoin, to start their Bitcoin journey, and then become deep experts in Bitcoin if they want to. So buy, sell, secure, send, receive, all of the core things you would ever need to do with Bitcoin. Our goal is to enable that for consumers and small, medium-sized businesses.
Terrific. And how are you regulated? Because I know that you've sort of structured the business a bit differently than others. What's the regulatory landscape for you all?
Great question. So a number of companies when they build in this space, they typically outsource as much as possible. They'll often outsource as much as possible to a third party financial institution, like a trust company or something like that. And they build sort of an app and marketing wrapper on top of that. So, which means that actually they're not actually able to touch their clients' funds. They can't touch their Bitcoin. They can't touch their dollars. They have to totally outsource all of that. They have no licenses. They're just doing sort of marketing and, you know, and sort of wrapping somebody else's financial institution. That allows them to move quickly, but it also has a number of downsides. It means that they actually don't have insight into where the coins are, and can't sort of 100% with 100% certainty know that, you know, the Bitcoin is safe. Like what happened at Prime Trust. Prime Trust was one of these companies that you sort of like wrap, you know, and deliver in your own app. Another downside is any sort of compliance limits and sort of key decisions are the decision of that third party and not you. So you have a lot less control over how you can serve your clients. There's a third party that they make the final call at the end of the day. And so we did things a bit differently. We did things the hard way. When we launched the company, we were only able to launch in 8 states because we said we never want to outsource custody. And we always want to be able to serve kind of the full stack of the needs of our client. And we want to be able to make all of the compliance decisions and all of the decisions on their limits and what they can do. And so because of that, we've had to go state by state and get licenses across the United States. They're called money transmission licenses. And so, you know, it took us a number of years to get all the ones we have now. We are still not in New York or Nevada. The New York has its own regulatory regime. New York has its own regulatory regime, and as does Nevada. But we do operate in the majority of the United States. And so by doing things the hard way, though, we've been able to sort of build this rock solid foundation that allows us to have full control over how our system works, how we serve our clients, and how their funds are kept safe.
So did you know going into it that this licensing was going to be something you'd have to contend with? Or is it like, would you just be prohibited from operating in any of these states if you didn't go through that process? Like this isn't like a hypothetical, because of the exchange of actual fiat currency, I assume is like Bitcoin isn't regulated per se by these, or perhaps in some states.
Increasingly,
or is it fiat? Okay. Yeah.
So we did know we would have to go state by state, mostly mm-hmm. for fiat back then when we started. It was mostly for fiat reasons. But since then, especially post FTX and all of that, a lot of states have said, you know what, Bitcoin fits into our money transmission rules. Okay. Some early on, there were a lot of states that said Bitcoin isn't money. You don't need a license. A lot of that has changed over the years. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we need more licenses now than we did when we started. But overall, sort of the licensing regime, while it's cumbersome, and while it does force a lot of overhead on the business, it honestly is a good framework to operate in. Ever since we started the company, we've had to get full financial audits. Mm-hmm. We have to run a very tight ship. We've just had to operate in a very mature way from day one. And honestly, that's a good thing. It's forced us to just, you know, operate with a level of maturity that most startups don't have to.
Yeah. So like if you're one of these companies that operates as more of like a marketing wrapper around another financial firm, is there any compliance? Do they have any of this, any similar compliance reporting audit requirements, or are they completely absolved of that sort of responsibility?
Well, they enter an agreement with a third party, and the third party, that agreement can look like a number of things. They'll typically still use like compliance tools, and then pass that information to the third party, and they'll sort of do some upfront vetting, but the third party can always, they have the final call, right? So they will often request extra information about a user you created and say, you know what, like we need more information about this person. At the end of the day, the hook is like the financial institution, like the buck stops with them. They're actually on the hook. But they sort of give a little bit of leeway to the wrapper if they trust them.
Got it. So like as a customer, you've got to kind of figure out what tree to bark up if something goes wrong, and it's probably a degree or two away from the interface that you usually experience.
Exactly. That's the issue. Sort of like the person, you know, that like customer service, they actually don't have any say over, like they're not the company that controls your assets. So any actual thing that gets held up there, they have to relay to this other company, that their incentive is not to serve you. Their incentive is to not get in trouble or not like, you know, to follow their policy. Right. And you kind of know how these things work at these big companies. It just kind of becomes, sometimes it can become like this Kafka-esque, like sort of bureaucratic quagmire.
Right. So, okay, we've touched on it, but I'm curious. I want to give you a chance to talk about this. So I'm a River client. That's where I buy my Bitcoin. I actually have a miner with you all as well. I know that's one of the few sort of third party reliances you have within the Bitcoin space is miner hosting. But I want to give you an opportunity, because what compelled me to start working with River and buying my Bitcoin at River was really actually hearing you on several podcasts talking about the way you've architectured the business. So besides obviously your own custodianship, and maybe you could elaborate a bit on how River does that, what are some other ways that you've designed sort of this machine to operate that's unique and deliberate, and I think your words, you know, slowly and correctly?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've deeply internalized the Bitcoin ethos just in how we've built the company. Part of that was just doing the hard regulatory stuff up front, even though it meant growing slower in the beginning, because it's unlocked us to grow faster now, right? We can move quickly. We can ship new features without requiring a third party to, you know, support it. It's also how we've built the team. We don't hire quickly. We don't grow our headcount very quickly. We're very deliberate. We're very slow, to make sure that every member we add to the team is compounding the value of the company and is truly the right culture fit. We never want to be one of these companies that we just like throw fiat at it and, you know, scale headcount 50% or 100% every year. And then we end up with this monstrosity of an organization that like nobody knows each other and like the culture's changed completely. So we have this culture at River of, you know, we will grow slower, to maintain culture and quality. And that's another sort of aspect to how we run the business. In bull markets, we don't go head over heels and hire a bunch of people and extrapolate a trend that, you know, where we might see a bear market on the downside and then have to fire a bunch of people. So we're very conservative and deliberate with just how we build the organization itself and the people. Product-wise as well, we try to craft things very carefully in a way that scales. You know, we focus on investing a lot in reliability and security, things that might slow us down from shipping as many features as possible, but keeps this rock solid foundation strong and over time actually allows us to move faster. So those are sort of just a number of sort of Bitcoin ethos ways we run the company. Also just from treasury management perspective, you know, we keep a lot of Bitcoin in our treasury. If Bitcoin continues to do, like, River won't do well if Bitcoin doesn't do well. So, you know, it's sort of like logical that we should hold Bitcoin because, you know, if this whole thing works, then we should also just have a much larger treasury because of it all. So we do deeply believe in this ethos of saving in Bitcoin as well.
That's fantastic. So we just, it feels like we've exited the bear market. We're probably head toward a bull run. Last week when I think started talking about this discussion, we were hitting all time highs and we've dipped a little bit as of today. We're recording Friday, March 15th. But I imagine that you're to some extent, the mindset, the way you think about running, building this business in a bear market is a bit different than a bull market. I assume probably right now the number of clients you're onboarding is, you know, relatively high versus, you know, a year ago. How does that evolution happen? Like, what were you doing a year, 2 years ago when we're, you know, I can't even remember when we were sitting at 15K versus today?
You know, our success today is the result of a work a year ago. So, you know, we spent the bear market tightening up our product, shipping things clients wanted, optimizing our backend systems to reduce manual work. A lot of this is around sort of, you know, like payments risk, payment processing. We invested a lot into automating a lot of that internally in the last year, which has allowed us to scale relatively smoothly in the bull market. Our roadmap honestly isn't changing a whole lot because of the bull market, because we've always sort of prioritized the sort of automation and reliability. It's not like we're like scrambling to all of a sudden, like, you know, be able to scale now. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, in a bull market, it is a little bit different because of the sheer number of and sheer growth of clients signing up, you just have more issues you have to deal with, right? More bugs get surfaced. More things start to get a little wonky in ways you didn't expect. So that does take some more engineering time. But by and large, we're sort of just executing on a roadmap that we set at the beginning of the year, and it's not being disrupted a whole lot.
Yeah. So you plan, when you think about the business, especially from a financial, you know, durability perspective, you think a lot about what's the difference in our business if Bitcoin's at 1 million versus at 15,000. Is that something that you're accounting for and ensuring if we have an 80% drawdown or something like that, it doesn't change any of the fundamentals of what we're doing? Perhaps we divest from certain activities or what have you, but is that kind of the way you think of it?
Yeah. We basically just assume it's always going to be bad. Like that's how I think. I just always assume a bear market's around the corner. And from a financial planning perspective, that's how we operate. Rule number one in this industry is survive and don't mess up. And so because of that, long tail risks matter, and we make them very like real internally and like just assume these things are possible and plan for it. So we have modeling scenario, like bull market modeling scenarios, like I don't really care about because like, great. But you know, the thing I care about, cause that's not an existential risk. That's just awesome. I care about the bear market, and that's basically what we plan around. It's like, okay, assume there's a bear market this year. We shouldn't do anything that puts the that is an existential risk to the business if a bear market happens.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, you get busy in these bull market, in these run ups though, I imagine. And what's the biggest challenge of that? Is it scaling? It sounds like you've got a robust technical stack on which to build and grow. Is the harder part like keeping up with, as a company that intentionally hires slowly and deliberately, is the harder part keeping up with like customer service and ensuring that you've got bandwidth for onboarding?
Yes, absolutely. That's the hardest part. We always want to maintain a high quality of service for our clients. And obviously that sometimes comes into conflict with this being very deliberate about hiring. It's like we don't outsource client services to the Philippines or something. Like everyone is very much a part of River. And now we were able to, the way we think about this is we focus on amplifying the effectiveness of each client service agent with more engineering work, right? So we actually do a substantial amount of engineering projects that allow our operations team to get more done per person. And that's actually where we make the biggest investments. So for example, right now, because of the growth of signups, right, there's, most clients, when they sign up, it's like a very happy path. Like everything looks good. You're automated in, everything's good. But there's, you know, a percentage where it's like, you know, the KYC information didn't check out. Like there needs to be a manual review. These queues are like growing. So it's a lot of manual work. And so we're putting a lot of work into, okay, how do we reduce the number of, you know, clients that get sent to that, you know, unhappy path? How do we make those reviews faster and more automated? And it's always things like that.
Mm-hmm. Does a lot of that
stuff that we should automate.
Yeah. Does, for example, the manual KYC reviews, does that stuff happen internally or is that a third internal party function? Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We basically do everything in house.
Okay. That's awesome. So I know you've got a somewhat technical background, and you're actually, when I'm trying to understand one of these more technical, okay, it's not my area of expertise, something like the Lightning Network, for example, which I know you and River have invested in. I'll look for a podcast with someone like you to maybe help make it simpler for me. Could you real briefly explain the Lightning Network and then talk about River's involvement and what you sort of the long-term play that you might see there?
Yeah. So the general idea behind the Lightning Network, mapping it to sort of the fiat world, is, you know, making a Bitcoin transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain it's relatively expensive. It can cost anywhere between $1 to sometimes $15 if the network is congested. It's kind of like making a bank wire in the United States. It costs like $20-$30, but you can send an unlimited amount of money. The Lightning Network is like the Visa of Bitcoin, where it's not for sending very large amounts of money, but it's for sending small amounts of money quickly. And you pay, and the fees are based on a percentage of the size of the payment. It's not like a fixed fee, regardless of how big the payment is. And the way the Lightning Network works is it treats the Bitcoin blockchain as a settlement layer, but it allows lots of transactions to happen above the blockchain at the second layer, is what it's called, which is, the second layer is the Lightning Network. And it's a network of nodes connected by payment channels, and any node that has a path to another node can pay it. And these channels are opened by making an on-chain Bitcoin transaction. They're closed by also making an on-chain Bitcoin transaction. And between, you know, opening and closing these channels, you can move money back and forth, between peers without making an on-chain transaction. Now, there are some benefits and drawbacks. The benefits is this is great for the Lightning Network is great for small to medium size, anywhere between $0 to $5,000, Bitcoin payments between custodial wallets. So between wallets where you're trusting that company with your coins, because, these companies often have big Lightning nodes. They're well connected and there's always a path to where you need to make this payment. So for example, if you want to send $5,000 from River to Cash App or from River to Kraken, that's just going to work great. Like the UX is becoming like almost seamless. But if you want to have a self-custody Lightning wallet yourself on your phone, that's where this gets kind of complicated. That's where the Lightning Network is still kind of challenging. There are great non-custodial self-custody Lightning wallets out there. Moon, M-U-U-N, Phoenix, and others. But it's still not as seamless as an on-chain transaction. And that's where it's still sort of like, you know, TBD, how good can that user experience get? So Lightning, in summary, is a way to scale Bitcoin payments, but it is not a silver bullet.
Mm-hmm. So you see, like, on Twitter, X, whatever we call it these days, you see people like at a coffee shop in El Salvador showing how they use Lightning, you know, they're paying for their coffee, which is kind of the funny use case that everyone always complains about with Bitcoin is I can't buy coffee with it or whatever. What's the delta there? But so you see it happening in real time. I mean, you know, people have experienced it. I've paid for things a couple of times on the Lightning Network with an app on my phone. What does it take to get from, you know, it being easy for Cash App and River to exchange on Lightning to, you know, a more global adoption and use? Like if today, if 8 billion people wanted to onboard to the Lightning Network, is it a liquidity constraint? Is it a technical constraint? Like what's the challenge?
So if the entire world wanted to onboard to Bitcoin and make Lightning payments today, it would work well if everyone was using custodial apps. So if, you know, El Salvadorians were using Chivo and Americans were using like River or Cash App, or, you know, Europeans were using Kraken, right? That all would work actually super well. Because also merchants would have custodial payment processors, right? Like Square payment processing might add Lightning too, right? And the European payment processor might add it. And so you actually, like, to serve the whole world custodially, you don't need that many Lightning nodes, right? A couple thousand companies can kind of serve all of that. It gets challenging if you want everyone to be able to hold their keys and make Lightning payments. That's where things get challenging. Got it. That's where, like, you know, mobile Lightning nodes and have opening a channel and locking up like Bitcoin liquidity with consumers at scale is an economic and technical challenge. Part of it's economic, part of it's technical. So I would actually say, though, the biggest friction or hindrance to Bitcoin being a medium of exchange globally isn't a technical issue. It's just people want to use dollars for that still. Bitcoin doesn't have product market fit as the global medium of exchange yet because of the economic properties of it in comparison to fiat currencies. Bitcoin is still very young. Bitcoin is still volatile. Bitcoin still appreciates over time. And all of these things, and the world is also just conditioned to want dollars. And the infrastructure for paying in dollars is just, you know, 100 times better. So I actually think that Bitcoin isn't going to, you know, come of age as this global medium of exchange until something very bad happens to the dollar or a material sort of chunk of sort of the global economy attempts to break away from the dollar.
Okay. So is the hang up for Bitcoin so the Bitcoin community tends to be, I know we're a diverse group. There tends to be sort of some homogeneity when it comes to like our philosophical biases, what Bitcoin needs to be for the world. So the hang up sounds to me a little bit philosophical, like not the end goal or the end objective is really for everyone to non-custodially transact on the Lightning Network. Is that sort of fair? Like I know, or at least a lot of the devs I imagine who are working on this and pushing that. Would you say that that's maybe a way of thinking about some of the problems? Because if we could use it tomorrow, I agree with you. We like the adoption rate's not high enough. Like we have not displaced the dollar as the preferred medium of exchange. That aside, if everyone wanted to tomorrow, would the hang up for Bitcoiners, broadly speaking, maybe be, well, they can't do that without trusting a third party?
So, I think it's directionally true. My take, my own personal take, I can't speak for everyone else. What's important to me is that you're able to non-custodially transact. What's important to me is that every human And whether it's the Lightning Network, I mean, I think that's a little too prescriptive. I think what's important is that every human is able to take custody and transact their Bitcoin in a censorship resistant, self-custodial way, right? Maybe Lightning solves all that for everybody. Maybe it looks like something else. There's different scaling solutions that solve different segments' needs. But I would say, like, overall, that's what's important. What's important is that everyone has the optionality to do that, or the ability to do that, not that they actually do. I think that if our world stays healthy, if our civilizations stay healthy, people will trust institutions. That's sort of like core to civilization, is that you can trust your institutions. I think what's awesome about Bitcoin is that it gives you the option to not trust your institutions, which actually makes your institutions more trustworthy, right? When you have institutions that you can opt out of, those institutions have a economic pressure to stay more trustworthy.
Yes. Okay. I like. Yeah. That's a really good way of framing it. So, as a non-technician, I've heard more and more rumblings of this sort of debate about Lightning, and there's sort of skepticism by some and a lot of optimism by others. Is what we're talking about here what that debate is ultimately sort of about in terms of its ability to scale? It's like everyone would agree with you that it's really not a technical challenge. I mean, it's not a technical challenge from a transactional perspective. It's a technical challenge from making it a censorship resistant network, giving everyone that optionality. Is that what the debate effectively is?
Yes. And I would say that people who've actually worked on Lightning, I don't think any of this is really new to them. I think there were sort of two categories. There were people who worked on Lightning and always knew sort of what the challenges were. Mm-hmm. And then there's people who weren't technical and sort of like marketed Lightning as like a silver bullet and are now sort of realizing, well, actually it's not a silver bullet, but all the people who actually were working on it knew that already. I think the dynamic is like finally a realization from sort of like the non-technical people, like this doesn't solve all of our problems overnight. There's still a lot of open questions about how Bitcoin can scale in a censorship resistant, non-custodial way. And it's not like this is a disaster, right? Like, nobody has solved this perfectly. There's just still lots of work to do.
Yeah. If you were to guess, is the solution somehow embedded in Lightning when we come up with it, or is it like another technology that either replaces Lightning or somehow complements Lightning to make this possible? Like, how do you see it playing out?
I don't know. It's possible somebody has an insight that nobody had before, and it sort of becomes a game changer. I think Lightning is going to be a core part of the future. Lightning is the only robust, censorship resistant layer two protocol Bitcoin has, right? Everything else is a back of the napkin sketch. The difference between those two things, like, cannot be overstated. Lightning is real. People have built multiple implementations that are hardened. These other ideas so far, like Arc or like, other layer two ideas, they're awesome. People should continue pursuing them, but they're nowhere near as real. Do I think people will have like other scaling ideas and technologies that will continue to move the needle? Absolutely. I hope so. I don't know what they look like though. There's a big push right now for Bitcoin L2s. That might be part of it. But that also, they kind of feel like they're just trying to bring the DeFi casino to Bitcoin, not actually necessarily solve like Bitcoin scaling. So I don't know. Yeah. It's still very early.
Yeah, no, makes sense. So let's shift gears for a minute. I know something that that you've talked about recently on X is this concern that OTC desks are going to run out of Bitcoin to sell. First of all, could you explain like the difference between what an exchange is, OTC desks, how they interface? This is something I've just begun to learn a little bit about, so I might have some follow-ups with you on that. And then let's jump into kind of the FUD. And
totally. Yeah. And to be clear, I said OTC desks are not running out of Bitcoin.
That's right.
Like FUD. Okay. The general question is sort of like, who are the actors in Bitcoin markets? Like, and if you want to buy Bitcoin, what are your options? And so the way I would break it down is, sort of the first bucket is exchanges. And exchange is a word that is often sort of overloaded. It's colloquially used to mean lots of different things. Some people call river an exchange, kind of, you know, but at its core, that really just means like there's an order book that gets traded and markets are made in this order book. That would be the biggest one is Coinbase Pro. Coinbase or Prime, they keep changing the name, but basically like there's an order book sitting somewhere and traders are constantly buying and selling off this order book. This order book has like all of the sell orders that people want to place at higher prices and all of the buy orders people want to make at lower prices. Anytime an order crosses, a trade happens and the new Bitcoin price gets updated from that. So that's like basically what the New York Stock Exchange is, right? In the traditional financial world, almost nobody is buying their Apple shares from the New York Stock Exchange directly, right? So they're going through a middleman who handles all of the trading on the exchange. So the same thing exists in Bitcoin land. So you have this exchange, these exchanges that have these order books, and you know people are like high frequency trading there. And then sort of the next layer is you have people who abstract all that away, and you go to them and you say, "I want to buy Bitcoin," and they say, "Okay, here's the price." Right? They make it super simple. They just you don't have to understand all of the financial complexities of executing on an exchange. You just say, "I want to buy Bitcoin," and they say, "Here's the price." And that's what River does. And it's a little more complicated than that because you know River is we're a brokerage. That the term for that would be a brokerage. We're sort of abstracting away the financial complexities of executing orders and making it simple for the user and saying and making a really simple experience. That's what a broker does, a brokerage. An OTC desk is it's kind of similar to what we do, but it's also kind of different. An OTC desk is very institutional. They typically don't have like a web app or anything like that. Sometimes they do. And you communicate them via like chat app or API, and they're also trading on exchanges. But they're also doing like custom deals. They're like calling miners. The miners like, "Yo, I want to sell 1,000 Bitcoin." They're like finding somebody else who wants to buy. And they're doing sort of all this often increasingly sophisticated stuff to fill orders. And their interface is also, you know, you go to them, you say, "Give me a quote for 1,000 Bitcoin," and then they send you a quote and you can choose to execute that quote or not. So River kind of, so the way River operates is when you place an order with us, we look at the whole market and we find the best price that we can for you. We're trying to give you the best price basically that we can. And we are, you know, you're buying the Bitcoin from us, but you know, we're sort of hedging that out on the back end through either OTC desks or exchanges.
So would it be fair to say that like the OTC desks have maybe a higher touch relationship with their clients, tend to be more institutional, perhaps high net worth, you know?
I wouldn't even say high net worth. I would say ultra high net worth. Okay. It's typically ultra high net worth or institutional.
Okay. So people with a lot of Bitcoin, a lot of potential liquidity. Miners was, I think, the example you gave. Yeah.
You know, another key difference with OTC desks, the difference between like a River and an OTC desk is with River, we are sort of like, you know, you connect your bank account, right? You click buy, we pull the funds from your bank. It's all very sort of like integrated with your banking, with all the stuff you have. With OTC desks, there's actually like this whole due diligence process. There's like trust on both ends in a way. So they'll do like, if you want to trade with an OTC desk, they'll want your balance sheet. They'll do a credit check on you, because the way it works is you trade, you know, back and forth all day, and then you settle out at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, you see like sort of, what is your net outstanding position? Do you owe them dollars? Do they owe you dollars? You know, which way did it go? And you know, you're like, each is sort of holding like sort of risk of the other, and you're settling out every day. So it's a much more like in-depth involved relationship, which is why it's very institutional. There's a lot of like documents and like due diligence and balance sheet analysis and stuff like that.
This episode of the Bitcoin Way podcast is sponsored by us, your friends at the Bitcoin Way. If you rely on a third party or closed source hardware wallet for your Bitcoin custody, you are compromising on how you store your wealth. The Bitcoin Way offers white glove service to help you take full self-custody of your Bitcoin and sleep in peace knowing you've done it right. Like most Bitcoiners, we believe that your Bitcoin stack will one day be worth a lot more than it is today. Go to thebitcoinway.com to sign up for a free consultation with a member of our team. Don't delay on protecting your wealth and reach out today. So now explain your OTC desks are not running out of Bitcoin. What was the concern frame, like sort of the argument that, or the concern that they were, and then why they're not?
So, I mean, it's sort of just a general misnomer and sort of a misunderstanding of what a market is, right? OTC desks, it's not like OTC desks started with a pile of Bitcoin that they just sell from and the pile is going away, right? Like, it doesn't make, like, that's not how any financial, like, operation works, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like they're just holding $10 billion of Bitcoin and then they just sell it down whatever the price is. They're making markets, right? They are matching, OTC desks are finding buyers and sellers and selectively taking risk. And, you know, sometimes they're long, sometimes they're short, et cetera. But they're not just like sitting on a pile of Bitcoin and selling it down. There was this general misnomer using like sort of like chain analysis and like stuff like that, saying these are all the Bitcoin OTC desks hold and it's going like this. And therefore, you know, no one's going to be able to buy a Bitcoin from OTC desks. It just doesn't really make sense because it's just not how it works.
Basically, it's the price pumps. It incentivizes more potential sellers, you know, institutions, miners to take a profit or what have you. And that's basically the price is finding that equilibrium. It's the discovery of that equilibrium between the buyers and sellers. And
exactly. By definition, the price somebody is willing to sell Bitcoin at. Right. Yeah. So like, markets don't run out of something, right. With Bitcoin, because, the price would just go to the next price somebody is willing to sell their Bitcoin.
At $10 million, someone's willing to sell a Bitcoin for $10 million. So right.
Exactly.
And at $100,000, someone's willing to sell their Bitcoin. So it's just a matter of what the price point is.
The implication of saying OTC desks run out of Bitcoin is like the Bitcoin price goes infinite, which just doesn't make sense.
Right. Got it. I guess the maybe a challenge they could run into, you know, just structurally as a business is, you know, losing relationships where like a particular OTC desk loses loses liquidity. They're not finding the right buyers and sellers at the right times, but that's just a function of running an effective organization. And, you know, maybe they go under, but there are others who do it better and more effectively.
Totally. You know, like, you know, if you're an OTC desk and you're unable to execute your trades competitively, then you're going to lose business, right? So that's also like competitive forces within OTC desks. Like, you know, if we're trading with OTC desks, we're going to go with who's ever offering the lowest price at that moment. So if you're not able to, you know, get your coins at a cost that's compelling to us, then, you know, you won't get trades, you won't get business.
Yes, makes a lot of sense. So let's shift gears as we kind of head toward the end here. What are some of your Bitcoin predictions for the next 12 months? If you're willing to give price predictions, would love to hear it. Always interesting. But what else do you anticipate us seeing in the world of Bitcoin?
Well, you know, my gut tells me we're going to see 100K this year. My gut tells me, obviously don't know, and Bitcoin will always do things you don't expect. But it just kind of feels right. You know, like I don't know how big the halving is going to be here. You know, historically, the halving has always, like, any impact the halving has had on price has always been quite delayed. If you know, it's always been like 6 months to a year later. I think the halving is going to be very interesting for miners. Hash rate has continued to skyrocket. At its current trajectory, we're going to see an exahash this year. A zeta hash. Yeah. Of hash rate this year. And that's 1,000 exahashes. And you know, that's very fast hash rate growth that we've seen. And although the Bitcoin price has substantially appreciated, hash rate growth in conjunction with the halving, I think that will put some pressures on miners, but I don't think necessarily we'll see a lot of hash rate drop off immediately. A lot of the stuff is sort of like long-term investments, and I think people will wait to see what the Bitcoin price does before just shutting off all their machines. A lot of these people have contracts, so it's not like shutting off means they don't owe anything. So mining dynamics will be very fascinating to watch this year. You know, I think the election is also a big catalyst. I think no matter who wins, the U.S. fiscal situation will continue to deteriorate. It's not like either party has shown any sort of, you know, fiscal responsibility in the last 30 years or 20 years, maybe. I think, you know, if Trump wins, life is a lot easier for Bitcoin companies, for sure. A lot of the regulatory pressure eases up. The Biden administration is just much friendlier to the sort of extremists in the Democratic Party, like Elizabeth Warren, who want to, you know, basically shut us all down completely. The average Democratic, you know, party politician doesn't actually want to, but it just, the door just stays open to the extremists. And a lot of those people are also leading regulatory bodies. So I do think that that risk goes away for 4 years if Trump wins. So that's also something that just paying close attention to.
Mm-hmm. It seems like four more years. Like we're already, I think Bitcoiners would almost unanimously agree. You can't shut down Bitcoin. You can ban it, but you can't kill it. I mean, it's unkillable in any meaningful sense. But I think four more years probably allows an adoption rate in the U.S. high enough that it becomes politically untenable. You know, like we're still in that, or we're still early, as we say. At some point, we are less early, and it really is. We have a critical mass of participants in this network within the United States that the Elizabeth War, that talk track becomes political suicide, I think, and it just dissipates.
Yeah. We're seeing a number. Yeah, exactly. Now, a concern would still be, well, they would say, okay, well, you can keep your, you know, BlackRock ETF, but you can't withdraw Bitcoin or something, right? And so I think Bitcoin will get to a scale where they can't like try and kill it as an asset, but they maybe can try and kill it as a self-sovereign asset. And they wouldn't be able to do it completely, but they could just make your life hard like they did for Napster, right? And that would be really bad for River. So we want to make sure that doesn't happen. I think another interesting trend is Tether. I think Tether on its current trajectory becomes a serious sort of just like player in the world. It is, and I think it'll be interesting to see what role it plays with the US government. It is potentially going to become one of the largest buyers of US treasuries. And one of the largest holders of U.S. treasuries. And so you get this weird thing where the U.S. government actually, like Tether is actually like an incredible thing for the U.S. government. It'll just like, it's this unlimited buyer of U.S. government debt. And so like the U.S. government, as long as, I think what we're seeing is basically the U.S. government being like, honestly, we don't want to shut this thing down. We just want to make sure they're not like it's not overtly funding terrorism. And so what we're seeing is like Tether will shut down an address if the US government says, hey, these guys are terrorists, because Tether also doesn't want that heat. And so you have this sort of maybe a symbiotic relationship forming. And I think we're going to see more conversations around this in like mainstream discussions.
Interesting. All right. So in a world where Bitcoin is used ubiquitously as money, what's the role of an exchange, or what's the role of River? Like how does River evolve or adapt to that when the ways you accumulate Bitcoin is earning or stealing, I guess are kind of your two options at some point. I know you probably, since we're probably a little ways down the road there, that's a little ways down the road, but just, you know, thoughts and when you think that day might come.
Yeah. So, sort of the way we think about it is, right, there's like kind of three buckets people have money: investments, your savings account, and your checking account. Bitcoin is winning the investments. It'll then eventually start winning people's savings accounts.
And I think very far down the road, it serves as like their checking account is Bitcoin too, right? Meaning that they're actually paying their bills in Bitcoin. They're getting paid in Bitcoin. They're like, I think we're at least 10 to 20 years away from that being a reality. I think mm-hmm. that over that time period, more and more people will behave that way. But like I said, until the dollar collapses, Bitcoin is not going to serve mainstream as somebody's checking, like taking over somebody's checking account functionality. And so that's sort of like the end state where like people no longer need to exchange dollars for Bitcoin that much anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're just actually like, I think we're so far away from that, that it actually just, it's not, we think about it, but it's not our core focus. We want to make sure that people who do want to live in a Bitcoin standard can do it through River. So we are thinking about that. But in the world where just people don't even have dollars anymore, River will still have a lot of, our business model would be different. We won't be making money from trading, but we will be able to make money by providing valuable services for people and being their Bitcoin bank. Because in that world also, people are probably borrowing Bitcoin, or people are need payment processing with Bitcoin. People need safe custody, and all of these things will be value added services we can provide that people are willing to pay for. Now, we would never run fractional reserve. Like the default at River will always be 100% custody. But in a world where people are saying, you know what, I want to borrow 10 Bitcoin to start a business, allowing people to opt into, lending that Bitcoin to somebody who wants to start a restaurant or something, like that's interesting, right? So, but I think that's quite a ways away.
Yeah. When you say quite a ways away, I mean, was 10 to 20 years a sort of a, like your best guess, or what's?
No, it's anyone's guess. I still think like, I try to like reason logically about this. Like, part of running a business is like, as much as like a hardcore Bitcoiner I am, I have to be extremely objective and rational about like the world, right? And so, I think like this future only happens if the US dollar, when and if the US dollar collapses. Mm-hmm. The timeline of that is anyone's guess. This stuff happens like, slowly and then suddenly, right? So I really have no idea when it's going to happen.
Yeah. I think for me, the challenge in thinking through that is, gold bugs have been calling this for a long time, and the anticipation is like, we can't kick the can any further. And then they do. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like at some point it does become untenable. It seems politically almost impossible to take any measures at this point to overcome the challenges, the fiscal challenges we face. Certainly cutting entitlement spending, the sorts of things that you would need to do would be too painful for too many people who have had it really good for a long time, that I just don't see it happening. But yeah, I agree with you. I don't know what that tipping point is. I mean, it feels to me like it's in the next 20 years, but it's going to be slowly then suddenly. I think people are going to wake up one day and we're going to just hit a wall.
It's also possible the dollar becomes Bitcoin backed or something. I mean, and there's some weird middle ground that we just can't really reason about yet. And that dollar still exists, but we're still living kind of on a Bitcoin standard, and it's this weird thing. So we try and see the future, but also are very realistic about like what our clients' needs will be in the next few years. And I don't think that's one of them.
Yeah, no, that's makes a lot of sense. Well, Alex, hey, I think we've covered a lot of ground here in about 50 minutes. I really appreciate your time. Could you give everyone a handoff where to find you, where to find River?
Yeah, so we're river.com. Easy to spell. We're at River on Twitter, and you can follow me. I'm just at my last name, so at Leishman. And yeah, if you're interested in checking out River, it takes 2 minutes to sign up and buy Bitcoin. We have a pretty cool app and some pretty cool features. So check us out.
Yeah, I'd encourage everyone to check out River. They're doing some amazing things. Alex, you're one of those resources I look to for sort of technical insight and, really getting perspective on what is the Bitcoin way of doing things. Cause I know you guys are doing some amazing things. So appreciate your time. Appreciate all the things you're doing for Bitcoin, and look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. As I said in the discussion, Alex really is one of those guys that I look to for thoughts and insight on what's happening in the world of Bitcoin. He really understands the technology and is also obviously doing some very cool things through River. And would encourage you all to check out River Financial. It's where I buy my Bitcoin. They're not a sponsor of the podcast. We don't have sponsors. It's just us. But they're a great Bitcoin only, very principled company. And again, as always, if you could, if you enjoyed the episode, like, subscribe, do anything you can to spread the word about our podcast. We'd really appreciate it. You can follow me on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it, at the other M Jordan. And of course, check out the Bitcoin Way. It's at the Bitcoin Way underscore. We hope to see you there. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.